Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how specific antioxidants can reduce oncogenic human papillomavirus infection in women. Louisiana State University, published in the Journal of Infectious Disease. Also, how exercise benefits in breast cancer linked to improved immune response. Massachusetts General Hospital, published in Cancer Immunology Research. We do the scholarship. We read every single day the peer-reviewed scientific literature, finding the studies that can show that there is valid reason to make lifestyle and behavioral changes. But also today, I'm going to shout out to Tucker Carlson, and I'd like people in this audience to send him a copy of today's program, at least that part, dealing with his comments last evening, where he had a physician on and who was really hyper-vaccination, really pro-vaccine, as is Tucker. And they talked about a death or two, six side effects from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, either because they're not aware of it, but the physician should be, because he's board certified, he's a retired surgeon, has an outstanding academic background, so there's no reason that he should not have known the true facts. So today I'm going to share with Tucker reasons why he has been misled, and therefore he has to start looking deeper than bringing on Dr. Siegel, his expert physician, who seems like a very nice person, but in my opinion, extremely limited in the advice he gives, and wrong on most of it. In any case, we are very specific. So for everyone today who's being yelled at and demeaned, even defriended because you're not getting a vaccine for whatever reason you've chosen, I'm going to provide you with in-depth, absolute scholarship information to show that you are doing so with a presumed, let's say, degree of caution, the precautionary principle, first do no harm. But I'm going to give you information on ivermectin today you're not aware of, and I'm going to guide you to the source. You can get it all for yourself. And if you want to get prescriptions and don't have a physician, I'll even give you information or provide you with information from board-certified physicians who will do that. So this is to show Tucker that he is only looking at one tiny piece of the vaccine puzzle. And also, you can download all of my articles on GaryNall.com on the subject of COVID, all of my articles on vaccines, the documentaries, award-winning documentaries, four of them on vaccines, and send this to show that this is a larger picture that I've spent over 30,000 hours researching over the last 50 years. So it's something I'm very confident with and familiar with. But the average person is not. The average broadcaster is not. And generally, when you're a producer of a show, you'll ask one of your, one of the people working for you, find out about this. And it's very quick, very fast. Everything is speeded up. It's not in depth. It's certainly not objective. So I believe that they gave substantially misinformation and wrong impression last evening, and I would like to see if he has the openness and the character to change, to completely look at the evidence, not my opinion, the evidence. And what I'm presenting today is evidence, hard evidence. Now, remember, he has the largest audience of any television show out there for an individual. He's like between 5 and 6 million people per night are watching him. Imagine if he became convinced on global warming that it was human caused, instead of being what amounts to a global warming denialist. If he became convinced by the evidence that vaccines do cause injury and they are inherently dangerous, and that's according to the Supreme Court, and I actually list that citation, then he wouldn't be caught up in this, I'm pro-vaccine. Well, vaccines are miracles. No, they're not. Not when they're actually studied honestly. So that's part of our program today. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. And I've been advocating the use of antioxidants for a long time. But this study says there are specific antioxidants that reduce oxidative stress. And that's really important because that can help women with the human papilloma virus strains associated with cervical cancer development. And there are five of them. So let's just make note of this and share it with all the women who would be impacted by this. There were 11,070 women who participated in this study through the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Here are the nutrients: vitamin A, vitamin B2, vitamin E, folate. Those are the top ones, but also I would add in there vitamin C and vitamin D. If you're getting those, you're going a long way towards protecting yourself from human papillomavirus infection, which in certain strains can lead to cancer. Also, from Massachusetts General Hospital, exercise training can slow tumor growth and improve outcomes for females with breast cancer, especially those treated with immunotherapy in ways that are, I believe, natural, stimulating the body's immune mechanisms. They tried this experiment at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. Tumors in mouse models of human breast cancer grew more slowly in mice put through their paces in a structured aerobic exercise program than in sedentary mice, and the tumors in exercise mice exhibited an increased anti-tumor immune response. So, exercise, slow down cancer development. Now, here's just common sense. If exercise slows down breast cancer development, why wouldn't it slow down all other cancers? It should. Maybe they haven't done the studies on each specific cancer, but you don't need the proof of every single cancer to know that exercise is good. How about this? Are there studies on this? None. But there is the work of Dr. Otto Warburg, who won Nobel Prize in physiology. He suggested that cancer does not thrive in a high oxygen medium. He gave examples of people living at higher altitudes having less cancer because the body has to stress itself to breathe deeper, greater lung function, deeper air, response to the air getting into the lower parts of the lung. And now, what if a person used hyperbaric oxygen therapy at 100% oxygen for an hour or more each day? And we know all the wonderful things it does to help limit stroke damage if you've had a stroke. But this is something that's never been researched that I can find. But I believe that we should be including in a brand new model of cancer prevention and treatment hyperbaric. Now, over the next 6 months, I will be doing a report. It'll be over 1,000 pages. But in that report, using only peer-reviewed literature, I will establish which therapeutic models actually work and not the games they play. And boy, do they play games. Let's say that you have cancer, stage 4, and they give you a prognosis of, let's say, 20 days to live. But they have a new experimental drug, and you try that, and you live 30 days. Then suddenly an article comes out in the peer-reviewed oncological journals showing that you have a statistically significant increase in lifespan. But you're not saying it's 10 days. Would people take $50,000, $30,000, $20,000 worth of additional drug therapy to live an extra 10 days if the quality of their life has not improved? I doubt it. But what about an oncologist who accepts, you know, a salesperson's pitch that, oh yeah, this gives you a 30%, 50%, 90% chance or 90% longer life, but it doesn't reverse the cancer. It just lengthens life. Then you have to look at the details, and that's where they play all these games that are meaningless in the real world. So we're going to have a real report on the best treatments, including all alternative treatments. And these are treatments that I have gone around the world, visited the clinics in depth, interviewed all the patients, all the medical staff in depth, and then waited 5 years to see how many of those patients are still alive and or not, and before I have written reports on them. That is the level of the scholarship that is used. All that information will be in there as well. Every herb, everything that is individually supported, I'll be giving a whole protocol, both orthodox and alternative. Anything that works in the orthodox model, I certainly support. But if it doesn't work, we should call it out and say this doesn't work. And the fact that 500,000 people per year are dying who only used orthodox therapy, and they died, and yet the entire cancer industry celebrates the great progress it's making. Well, I would challenge that that's progress when 500,000 people under your care are dying every single year for the for decade after decade after decade. When 20 to 30 million people under your care die, shouldn't you think that something should be questioned? But it's not. So do your exercise if you have breast cancer. Of course, there's a lot more you could do. Indole-3-carbinol, isothiocyanate, eating more broccoli, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, juicing, green juices, getting rid of sugar, caffeine, alcohol, and meat in the American diet. That also helps as well. Also, higher dietary total antioxidant capacity is associated with lower risk of cognitive impairment. This is from the National University of Singapore, published in the Journal of Gerontology. And what it means is very simple, that antioxidants, the right ones, taken in this group of 16,700 participants in the Singapore-Chinese health study, having men and women both from 45 to 74 years of age and over a five-year period, they found that certain antioxidants make a difference. And you pretty much know what they are. Vitamin C and vitamin E, carotenoids, that's from your fruits and vegetables, flavonoids, those are from your berries, other fruits and vegetables. The more of those you have, you can have a reduction of at least 25% in the risk that would have otherwise. Well, 25% from just that, that's terrific. You know, if you're looking at alpha flavonoids, anthocyanins, flavon-3-ols, flavones, flavanols, those are all associated with lower risk of dementia. And that's where you're juicing, you're eating a broad spectrum of fruits and vegetables. That's where you get it. And finally, from Zhenzhou Tong University in China, comes a study about the benefits of quercetin. Now, yesterday I told you how quercetin works. Quercetin is just one of those wonderful antioxidants. Eat an apple, you're getting quercetin. Eat an onion, you're getting quercetin. Take a supplement, you're getting a lot more quercetin. It helps with rhinitis. So, that's important. And, quote, asthma is a chronic inflammatory airway disease characterized by reversible glottalet cells, smooth muscle, hyperplasia, airflow obstruction, hyperactivity enhanced, ultrastructural remodeling, and airway mucus production. The current experiment study was aimed at scrutinizing quercetin's inhibitory effect on the airway inflammation. And that's exactly what it did. So, the more quercetin you take, the less inflammation you have, and the better your immune modulation is, and that can help you with asthma. It can also help you with COPD. Oh, and by the way, from Zurich in Switzerland, they found that dementia diagnosis turns the world upside down, as we know, not only for the person affected, but also for their relatives. But brain function gradually declines. Those affected lose their ability to plan and remember things or behave appropriately. At the same time, their motor skills are deteriorating. Ultimately, the dementia patients are no longer able to handle daily life alone and need comprehensive care. In Switzerland alone, more than 150,000 people share that fate. In the United States, millions. So what they found was that all the attempts at drug therapy, none worked. None. But better cognitive ability thanks to training and play. Yes, fighting dementia with play and getting people to play, getting people to dance, getting people to sing, and getting people to relax into games of any kind, that makes a difference. 8 weeks of training for dementia patients is what it took to start seeing improvements. So let's not just let the medical community say, wait for a drug. Let's get them walking, singing, playing, playing checkers, playing cards. Get them, give them mental challenges. Oh, and by the way, from the University of Montreal, published in Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, maple syrup protects neurons and nurtures young minds. That's correct. Now get the organic and crude, the first press of maple syrup. But now these researchers found that maple syrup has some really strong nutrients in it that protect your neurons. And that means you're protecting your brain. And that's good. The CDC's injury figure is certainly far undercounted. CDC claims only 10% actual vaccine injuries are reported. That's the CDC saying they're 90% underreported. So what are we actually looking at? Tucker, we're looking at 540,000 injuries in the United States and probably in the neighborhood of around, I would say, probably 12,000 deaths. And that's, you know, that's being realistic when you consider how many people died and it was attributed to something else. So what we have here is, as we see large numbers of vaccine adverse effects, although deaths reportedly from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine remain relatively low, given that as of today, the National Vaccine Progress Tracker has 84 million people, that's 25% of our population, having received one shot, and 43 million now fully vaccinated with two. We seem to have forgotten the statistics from original vaccine trials that are still ongoing. Moderna, for the highest dose group, 100% suffered side effects. Listen again, 100% of all the people suffered serious side effects after both doses. 21% suffered severe events requiring medical attention. That's a huge number for Moderna. We forgot that Pfizer trial had to be halted because of transverse myelitis. Remember, Forbes reported, quote, it appears that these trials are intended to pass the lowest possible barrier of success, end quote. Would you get on an airplane with someone that was the first day out of flight school and they had never taken another flight outside of a simulator in a warehouse? I don't think so. Former professor at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Hasseltine, said the results were all, quote, designed to succeed, end quote. For the three vaccines, their trial protocols, Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson, do not require that it prevent serious disease, only that they prevent moderate to severe symptoms. Now, you've mentioned several times that, you know, about people getting the vaccines, being able to go back to work, things returning to normal. By what measure? Look at Israel. Israel was one of the most aggressive, not the most aggressive, vaccine country in the world. And what's the population of Israel? What, around 9 or 10 million people? I'm not certain of the exact number, but they're on a track to vaccinate the entire population. There are individuals, for example, 12,000 individuals who were COVID negative took the vaccine and became COVID positive. All around the world, people who were negative of COVID took the vaccine, became positive. Why isn't that discussed? Because people are the mindset, if I take this vaccine, I won't get infected. That was never part of any trial. There is no evidence whatsoever, zero evidence in all the world's scientific literature that taking a vaccine for COVID will prevent COVID or prevent the transmission of someone who has it to another person. And also, Although there is serious debate about vaccine enhancement raised by Dr. Bosch and Michael Yeat and others, back in March of 2020, Reuters on March 11th, quote, studies have suggested that coronavirus vaccines carry the risk of what is known as vaccine enhancement, where instead of protecting against infection, the vaccine can actually make the disease worse when a vaccinated person is infected with the virus, end quote. Well, how about this? How about people in Gibraltar in a nursing home? None were COVID. They got the vaccine and they died. And the same happened in Norway and in other countries. Those who were most risk in those senior citizen centers who didn't have that, they died. And consider the recent Israel study from Tel Aviv University. Those who got the Pfizer vaccine had an 800% increased risk of getting the new COVID variant compared to those who were unvaccinated. Again, an example of vaccine enhancement. This virus seems to continuously mutate and evolve. This danger has been well known for coronavirus vaccines back in 2012. Quote, the Chinese, the Americans, the Europeans all got together and said, we need to develop a vaccine against coronavirus. Around 2012, they had about 30 vaccines that looked promising. They took the four best of those and gave those vaccines to ferrets, which are the closest analogy when you're looking at lung infections in human beings. The ferrets had an extraordinary good antibody response, and that is the metric by which FDA licenses vaccines. The ferrets developed very strong antibodies, so they thought. We hit the jackpot. All four of the vaccines worked like a charm. Then something terrible happened. Those ferrets were then exposed to the wild virus, and they all died. They developed inflammation in all of their organs. Their lungs stopped functioning, and they died. End quote. How about one of the most irresponsible vaccine ventures back in the 1960s to develop the RSV vaccine, upper respiratory illness similar to coronavirus? At the time, quote, at the time they did not test it on animals. They went right to human testing. They tested it on about 35 children, and the same thing happened. The children developed a champion antibody response, robust, durable. It looked perfect, and then the children were exposed to the wild virus, and they all became sick. Two of them died. They abandoned the vaccine. It was a big embarrassment to the FDA and National Institutes of Health. End quote. Those are just some of the considerations. And why in the world would we look for a vaccine when we already have a drug, many drugs, but I'll give you an example, an in-depth example. In fact, I'm going to send you the peer-reviewed literature on how many studies were done on this. I'll give you some insights. I won't review everything, but the efficacy in the prophylaxis as well as the treatment. And so here is just an overview of ivermectin. 50 trials, 395 scientists, 15,784 patients, 26 randomized controlled trials, 88% improvement in prophylactic trials, 81% improvement in early treatment trials, 43% improvement in late treatment trials when a person's already sick, 76% improvement in 18 mortality results. That is phenomenal. 66% improvement in 26 randomized controlled trials. So when someone says, as they have, and you talk about talking points where all the media says the same identical words, that means they're being fed propaganda. Why is it that I can find peer-reviewed literature on PubMed, high-quality trials, and experts in the fields, MD, PhDs, who are the leading world scientists who are praising ivermectin? It's non-toxic, less toxic than an aspirin, and it can stop symptoms real quick in a matter of hours or even days. What if it was used in every hospital? One expert claimed that we could have saved about 80% of all the people who died. Is it worth it? Not to the people making the vaccines, because then it's going to interfere. Why take a vaccine when you can take an inexpensive and highly safe drug that can control the symptoms? So why isn't that talked about? Why isn't hydroxychloroquine talked about? Why are the proponents of these attacked? And yet it won, ivermectin won a Nobel Prize for its global and historical impacts in eradicating endemic parasitic infections in many parts of the world. So SARS succumbs to ivermectin. The science is there. It is complete. If you want to reduce your chance of dying, ivermectin, vitamin C, and a quality antibiotic like azithromycin. So those are some things that you are clearly not aware of, and you're still the pro-vaccine. Well, I have a lot of articles that I've written on vaccines. Not once have I had a challenge where I had to respond and change any of my statistics. They are medically vetted, they are legally vetted, and they are scholarship vetted, so people can use my articles in a court of law. So I share this with you because I just believe that for whatever reason, and I'm not guessing, the people that you're getting your research from are not aware of how to do real research at the scholarship level that makes a difference. Now we're going to play a few clips. These clips are short clips, just short clips, but I have over 100 interviews I've done, some for an hour long, all on posted. But these are just some, and all the people you're going to hear are outstanding, orthodox, pro-vaccine scientists, the very type that you invite on your own program. But they have done their homework, and here's what they have to say.
Good afternoon. We are going to get started.
Expertise. So I want to be able to share with you today actual science. You know, we get a lot of politics from one side, the other side. I'm not here to offend one side or the other. I'm here to speak data. And the data speaks the truth. And so I have no agenda. I just want people to understand, one, what public health messages have we been missing? You know, what treatment should be available to everybody? I want to talk a little bit about the, quote, vaccines. And then I want to open it up to questions, because I could talk on this for probably 3 hours or 3 weeks. So, you know, this, I've only read maybe 6,000 articles in the last year, only seen, you know, like I said, 100,000 patients. So hopefully buckle up and something useful. If one person walks away and I help save a life, then I've accomplished my purpose here today. So thank you for the opportunity. Thank you to my friend Craig in the back. I know he's got some handouts if some people are interested as well. So thanks for inviting me. And thanks to Lieutenant Governor's office as well. I'm honored to be here. All right. Dustin, my friend, let's advance here, and we shall proceed. He's the man with the magical buttons. Yeah, go to the next slide there, if you could, please. Oh, it's right there. This is where we are right now. So does that look like a pandemic? It was. It's not anymore. We are in an endemic now. Statistically, the pandemic is over in Idaho. Statistically, yes. Once we're below a set percentage, we are not in a pandemic right now. Is the disease present? Sure it is. Is it widespread? No. You know, we're still doing maybe 500 to 600 patient tests a day. At most, we're seeing 2% per day right now. And so the numbers are going way down. Next slide, please. You're doing the next slide, and I'm not. You're one ahead of me there, Dustin. We are past a pandemic stage. We're at an endemic stage. In most states, we are. Their numbers are still high in a few states, but we're getting past that point. And here's why. Coronaviruses are seasonal. They follow a 6 to 9 month life cycle, and no matter what we do, they're going to do what they do, and then they're going to fade. What happened to SARS? What happened to MERS? What did we do to stop them? Nothing. They did their thing. Average COVID-19 death age, 78.6. Average age of death in North America every year, 78.6. That's fascinating. What are our highest risk factors? Obesity, low vitamin D levels, advanced age. 90% of deaths in the state have been over 70 years of age. That's the at-risk population. We have stopped our society for something that's taking people that are already at that death risk age anyway. The virus is fragile. These are just little tidbits. It's fragile. It doesn't live outside. UV light fractionates it, kills it, blows it apart. Ventilation in the wind blows it away. It is insanity to wear a mask outside. It is absolute insanity. And that's science. That's science. There is not one study that has shown any super spreader event to have occurred outside. They have all been indoors with poor ventilation. Next slide, please. All right, biggest lost message on this entire pandemic is vitamin D. There is no such thing, and if I can give one message to all of you for every winter and autumn for the rest of your lives, there is no such thing as flu and cold season. There is only low vitamin D season. Next, please. Vitamin D. Every cell in your body, every nucleus has a receptor for vitamin D on it. 2,000 genes in your body are controlled by vitamin D. 5% of your body's genome controlled by vitamin D. It is the master key to your immune system, the master key. If one has a level in mid-range, you cannot develop a cytokine storm. Data shows what kills people? Cytokine storm. If you are in mid-level range, you will not die from COVID because you cannot get a cytokine storm. Next, please. All right, so we don't just have a viral pandemic. We have an international vitamin D deficiency pandemic, i.e. 70% of the world is immune suppressed. 70%. 70 to 80% of all Americans are immune suppressed because they are D deficient. 82 to 88% of nursing home patients are D deficient. Who's dying at the highest rate? Nursing home patients. 83% of African Americans, 70% of Latinos, 72% of Native Americans, 47% of Caucasians are insufficient, and 70% are deficient. And well, 47% are deficient. 70% of Caucasians are insufficient. 80% of all hospitalized patients statistically are vitamin D deficient. 96% of people in the ICU are vitamin D deficient. If you are D deficient, you are immune suppressed, you are susceptible to the common cold, the flu, coronavirus of any sort, bacterial pneumonia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The best mask of all is a healthy immune system, and a healthy immune system does not occur. Next slide, please. If you don't have D in normal range. Well, how do we get D? Sunshine. You know, we synthesize it through our skin. Above the 35th parallel in the world.
The saying is simple. How simple is this? If we all have enough vitamin D, then our immune system is strong enough that when we come into contact with viruses, including this virus, we have a very high probability of not getting sick or a minor sickness. But our older individuals in America are grossly deficient in this, and people who are obese are very, very deficient in it. And we've been writing about that and talking about that. When was the last time anyone in the federal government, the state government, the local government advocated producing vitamin D, vitamin C, in zinc packets and giving them to all the citizens of the United States? If you did that, you would have people who would be defended against multiple infections and with no adverse effects from vaccines. Because we're in an experimental model. We will only know if this works in 2 years from now. Remember how you criticized Nancy Pelosi when she said that she got this gigantic report for a law that was supposed to be passed, and no one had read it. No one in Congress read it because it was too big. So we'll know what's in it once we pass it. That's the most insane statement I've ever heard a legislator make, and I've heard a lot of insane statements. Well, saying we'll only know how safe and effective this is in 2 to 3 years from now, when our human trials are over. And that's exactly what we're not doing. Here's another statement from a different person. Mind you, these are longer interviews, an hour long in many cases. I'm just giving you little insights. And all of these are pro-vaccine, mainstream, orthodox scientists or physicians.
I'm a consultant for a law firm called Baum, Hedlund, Aristi & Goldman in Los Angeles, California. And so this book that you just mentioned grew out of a series of cases that I worked on as a consultant with Baum Hedlund. And in particular, I teamed up with a psychiatrist called John Girardini in Australia. And we wrote a number of articles together on the subjects of corrupted industry-sponsored clinical trials. And eventually, we thought that we had enough for a book. And so The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine was finally produced after trying to find a publisher that had the courage to move forward with it.
And I want to get back to what is included in that book, but for the time being, I'd like to go back to an article that you wrote, a research piece.
With the branding of a key opinion leader and that key opinion leader's university affiliation, is worth an enormous amount of money in terms of confidence. Let's say, for example, they want to buy 1 million copies of these reprints because it's a blockbuster drug, and the sales reps are now going to go distribute the reprints of this journal article. So now the journal is obviously going to become enormously rich on the basis of the reprint sales of the journal article. And also today, there's another phenomenon where journal articles have open access, and that's replacing the model of the reprint issue, but it's the pharmaceutical industry that's paying for the open access.
Did you participate in the Vioxx stuff, or you just studied it for your paper?
This is not a case I worked on, so I don't know in a lot of detail, but I can speak briefly about the fact that there were problems that they knew about when they were conducting their clinical trials with regard to stroke and heart attack. And in this one particular case, they had a manuscript ghostwritten where they downplayed heart attack cases. And the professor who put his name on this paper was then confronted with the fact that there were patients in this trial that had died of heart attacks and were not, in fact, reported in the paper. And his response to this was, well, I went with the data that Merck gave me. So this, I think, is the essence of the problem that I referred to before, where you've got a lead author on a paper who can't guarantee the content of the paper that's been published in his name. Why is that? Well, it's because the data is owned by the pharmaceutical company, and they release it according to their own interest.
What are adverse events, and how does ghostwriting help hide adverse events?
Well, there are a number of ways in which marketing people will slice and dice the data once it has been sort of analyzed by the statisticians. And that's, you know, a very sort of tricky process of statistics as to how all of this can be manipulated. But the one sort of instance that's discussed in my book, it has to do with coding. And coding is how you describe an adverse event in terms of some particular kind of term. So let's say, for example, in the case of a particular clinical trial for an antidepressant tested on children, you get lots of adverse events, which include suicidal ideation, suicidal gestures, suicidal attempts, or even completed suicides. Now, this became a problem with regard to antidepressants for children because we got a black box warning from the FDA on that eventually. And the paper I'm thinking of in particular, which was Study 329, which is now famous for this particular little tactic, what they did was they coded suicidality or suicidal events as something they called emotional liability. So it was basically hidden in the coding. And emotional liability, nobody even seemed to know what that term even meant. But it basically means anything from crying on the one hand all the way to sort of attempting suicide.
What are the other common ways?
Here's why this is important. It shows you how much of Big Pharma has influenced the outcome of peer review studies, of the research grants given and research money given to major universities, and how that can compromise the outcome of a study. In fact, Dr. Angel, the former, she's now, I believe, or was at Harvard, but was for 20 years plus the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, wrote some excoriating articles condemning the pay-to-play within medicine and science. So until such time that there has been an independent review of the actual science behind this, then there is no way that you should have any confidence in any product, drug, or vaccine that Big Pharma brings forward. In fact, the whole emphasis now is on how many people can get the vaccine. We're short on vaccines. Line up and get your vaccine. They get a second vaccine. Oh, now we got variants. And the variants means that the current vaccine may not be of any value at all, so you're going to have to get shots maybe on a monthly basis. It's all a game. And it's only when you step out that you realize of that circle, wow, why have the great Barrington authors, one of the top professors at Harvard, at Oxford, and at Stanford, had over 50,000 scientists and physicians sign a petition showing that the lockdowns don't work, it's never been done. The science of social distancing and mask using came after the implementation of it. Well, since when in the world do you tell people to do something and you don't have any science to back it up? And then you make stuff up as you go along. So everything you've been taught about this has been partial truths or full lies. So we're sharing this information with you now with the hope that you will reconsider or even invite some of the scientists that we've invited onto your program and interview them, you know, and see what they have to say with your interview. All right? That's hopefully someone will send that out and send him the articles on COVID, send him the information on ivermectin, which has all the scientific citations from the peer-reviewed literature, send him the information on vaccines so he has a larger understanding. And hopefully he will reinvestigate these things and come back with a different decision of what to do. I'm Gary Nall, and I want to thank everyone for listening. However, I also want to mention that we have a special for you today. I don't have a lot of time. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pass on the special for today, and we'll save that for tomorrow. But please send this out to Tucker, because virtually everyone else in the media on any channel is pro-vaccine, pro-Big Pharma, and that's because it's being sponsored and promoted by the media. You cannot trust the mainstream media. You simply can't. Why? Because they lie. They all have their own political, ideological, or financial agendas. I'll just give you one example of how bad that is. Yesterday, Veritas, a group that does undercover investigations, and they just won a lawsuit in the state Supreme Court in New York against the New York Times. Now they say they're going to be suing CNN for slander. They filmed undercover one of the top tech people, one of the directors of technical work at CNN, bragging about how, as a whole network, they worked together to keep Trump from being president. He gave an example of how in some picture or video, Trump was shaking his hand, and so they had on dozens of people talking about his state of health, he's not fit. This was a coordinated conspiracy. This was a conspiracy of people at the highest level to get a guy from being president. Now, I don't like Trump. I would never vote for Trump, but that's not the point. The point is not that Trump should or should not be president. The point is that we should not have a corporate media for-profit organization deciding to manipulate the outcome of an election because the people in power that they want in power, who are friends with them, are the people that they're going to get there. We already saw that with Facebook. We saw it with algorithm manipulation with Google. We saw it with Twitter. All of the big corporations in America are now getting on the side of we want to dictate the laws, we want to dictate the policies. No, you're supposed to be selling people product or services. You're not to tell people which politic they should believe in and which politician they should trust. So all of the Russia mongering that was all lies and all the FBI investigations and all the other investigations all proved to be fruitless, that shows you how deep the misinformation is and the propaganda goes. They control the White House, the Senate. They control the judiciary, they control the media, and the deep state controls them. So where does that leave you? Just be conscious of where you get your information and what you do with it. And now for something that is a little different. How many people have been so indoctrinated into cults or political movements or even social justice movements They lose their sense of identity, personal identity. Their identity becomes the movement. I've seen this happen so often in my career. You can't have a conversation with them because every single thing you say, they bring it right back into what their indoctrinating program tells them is right or wrong, acceptable or not. It's like talking to a brick wall. So this you might find of interest. This is Kerry Smith, who for over 20 years was a leading activist and feminist. And she talks with Zuby about how she became a social justice warrior after being brainwashed by women's studies and theory courses in universities 20 years ago. She also explains how she spread these ideas online to convert others, a real hardline person. So it's interesting, whether you accept or reject, and you can do either, I think it's important we hear from people who are looking back after coming to a crisis in their life and deciding, I want to change. And when they do, they suddenly are free to look at, understand their previous self. Now to Kerry Smith.
What did you actually learn in that women's studies course? Like you said that university is where you got indoctrinated in your own words, but like what did they actually teach you?
So I took, as part of the women's studies minor, I also took critical race classes. I took queer theory classes because this is all interconnected. It's all part of one ideology. What they taught me to do was that the best way to view the world and to interpret everything in the world is through a filter of everything is racist or sexist or homophobic or transphobic. And so you've got to look for it and be able to find out where it is. So like I took a class on women and religion, and the class starts from a conclusion. The conclusion is that the Bible is sexist. Now we will take the Bible apart and prove our conclusion. But you start from a place of conclusion. And so what they're doing is teaching you that that the only way, the best way, and the only way to look at the world is as a competition between identity groups. Mm. And that you can't be, they hate when people say they're colorblind, or they hate when people say they don't treat people differently because of race and sex. This is why they try to convince us all that we all have implicit bias, because they're like, no, none of us are colorblind.
Sounds like an alt-right training camp.
It's totally.
That's why it's so funny, because I'm like, it's the same thing.
It is the same thing. Yeah, we have to, the most important thing I can do when I meet you, this is what they teach you, is to look at what race you are and what sex you are and treat you differently because of it. And that's actually what they did. I mean, I read a lot of, we read a lot of like postmodernist writers. We read a lot of, see, I didn't realize that what I was learning was a form of Marxism. Mm. And I didn't know, you know why? Because I didn't have enough context from school. And I went to a science and math school. I went to a school that I had to apply to get into. It was free. It was the state paid for it. But for 11th and 12th grade, it was supposed to be for the best and brightest in my state. And you go and live there. It's a residential high school. And I didn't have, and I had a great history teacher there, but I didn't have the historical context to know anything about Marxism or communism or socialism.
No, they ignore that. They'll teach all the Nazi stuff and the Holocaust and everything like that. But communism, Soviet Union, Cambodia, any of that stuff, it not a peep.
And why is that? Because I think there's a reason why they don't teach it.
I think there's a couple reasons. I think the one of the most obvious ones is that in the Second World War, both the UK and USA at some point allied with the Soviet Union. So even at that point in World War, like there was a lot of hush hush about the bad stuff that was happening in the Soviet Union. It was presented to the population of the UK and the USA in more of a positive light. And so the horrors of the Holocaust and of Nazi Germany, Nazi Germany was the enemy, right, of both the UK, all the allies. So that was fine. Whereas the Soviet Union helped eventually to defeat Hitler. So the way that, you know, how they say history is written by the victors. So in some ways that, you know, one of those ideologies and leaders is presented in a certain way and demonized as Hitler and Nazis should be, but most people don't even aware of the fact that more people died under communism than under Nazism, right? And I didn't know this myself until my early 20s when I actually went and like read up on some of this stuff, and I was just like, whoa, how did I make it all the way through university without even being aware of all this stuff? And then, you know, they had the Soviet Union, then you had Cambodia, you had Cuba, where else has this been done? You know, it's like this has happened. So I think that's the main factor. I think that's the main reason. And then I think the second one is just obviously academia has a huge leftist bias. So they want to show the evils of far right ideology, but because far left ideology is closer to a lot of teachers and lecturers and stuff, whether or not they'd admit it, because it's kind of closer to them, I don't think they want to share it in the same way.
I saw a stat there that said, I think it was like 30%. It was pretty high, something pretty high. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me, but it was a large percentage of university professors in the humanities who self-identified as Marxists. And that's just the ones who are not afraid to say they are.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think you're right. I think I didn't learn. You say you learned in your early 20s. God bless you. I didn't learn until my late 30s. Like I feel like I'm trying to download all these, you know, a bunch of history and philosophy and just things that I shut myself off to because of this ideology. It's like an intellectual prison. I've described it this way before, but it really is. You kind of lock yourself, you lock your curiosity away. You're not actually thinking. You're sorting through information. You're sorting through tenets of the belief system, and you're trying to pick the correct things to say. You're not actually thinking. And so to leave that has just been like, it's amazing.
How did you manage to stay in that bubble for so long?
That's a good question. A large part of it was online. It definitely was, because I started after college, I started frequenting a lot of feminist message boards. There was one called Chick Click, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was supposed to be just a message board for ladies, but me and some other feminist SJWs took it over and started, I was preaching, we were converting people. Oh, I was speaking the good word. This is like 20 years ago. I was teaching people about, look, hey, racism equals prejudice plus power. Okay.
Oh gosh. You know? One of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Sexism equals prejudice plus power. And I was like lecturing people on all this stuff that has now become mainstream. Back then people thought it was wacky, but we converted an entire board pretty much. Interesting. And I have printouts. Actually, Carter and I were joking. We should start giving people some of my embarrassing SJW, because of course I saved it, because I thought this was all brilliant thoughts that I had.
Okay. Oh, glad you still have it.
Yeah, it's so embarrassing. It's like cringe. Wow. But after that, the message board, just like with social media, you can, you know, I'm sure you know this, I'm just repeating what people know, but you can really severely limit what you're exposed to. And that's what I did. I had a carefully cultivated echo chamber of people in entertainment, which I worked in, and people in activism. I was really skilled at working with nonprofits, in SJW nonprofits, to promote my clients. So I would have we would have comedians doing stuff for the nonprofits, and nonprofits then pushing the comedians when they were on tour or what have you, or when they're on a TV show. So my whole world was like professional SJWs. It wasn't the traditional entertainment world. It was it was more, I would say, SJW journalists and activists, and those are the people I worked with to push my clients. And so that's all I really saw. And if somebody had a differing opinion, like I had opinions about, I'm sure this is no shocker to people who have certain ideas about what SJWs are like, but I had opinions about people I had never actually checked out.
Yeah.
Like I thought Steven Crowder was just a raging bigot, you know, and I don't think I'd ever watched anything like Ben Shapiro is the devil. Right. Oh, you know, like, because they don't ever give you the source material. They tell you what to think. You're reading things from Media Matters. You're reading things that from Huffington Post that are saying basically like, here's what to think about Ben Shapiro, that, they're not that, but that's what they're saying. And here's something he said, and we're not going to give you the clip, the link to the video, so you can watch it yourself. We're going to tell you what to think about it, so you feel like you've watched it and you're informed now, and you can go argue about something that you've never taken the time to investigate on your own.
Yeah,
so that's what that world's like.
That's fascinating. So this is cool. It's like speaking to a real life former SJW.
Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.